Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. It's been more than 30 years since Nelson Mandela was released from prison, but it's been nearly 60 since he said, "There comes a time in the life of a nation when there are only two choices, submit or fight." Well, the choice to fight was what spawned Mkhonto we Sizwe, MK, or Spear of the Nation, which in turn, later, gave birth to the Ashley Creel Detachment. In a book called Voices from the Underground, 18 members of the detachment give personal accounts of their involvement during the later 80s. The stories are terrifying, traumatic, appalling, shameful. But the process of putting them all together in one book is almost a story in its own right. I spoke to editors and members themselves, Shanil Harijaran and Shirley Gunn, director of the Human Rights Media Centre, who explained what the detachment was all about.
The Ashley Creel Detachment was named after a young activist, a young from Bontehevel, and he was brutally killed at short range by Jeffrey Benzine. He would have been part of our detachment, but it was called after him due to this tragedy that befell, and unresolved, I would say. It came up through the TRC and with a very unsatisfactory finding, where the security police said that they had shot Ashley in self-defense. Now, MK, the short for Mkhonto we Sizwe, is the armed wing of the ANC. Ashley had left the country in 1986, and I had also left the country in 1986, and so had Anis Sali, and Anis came back into the country a little bit before me, and he would have been part of setting up the underground structures, and my instruction was very different. The conditions in Botswana, and we communicated with our command in Botswana, was very, very difficult at that time. There was cross-border raids by the South African Defence Force, and there was a great deal of paranoia, fear, and disarray. And there were delays in both of our, Anissa's particular mission and my mission, working effectively. And so we had proposed that we work together to form underground detachments, and that is what we did.
So what was the time frame? When are we looking at?
Well, we were trained, some of us were trained outside in 86, and 87, returned back in 87. And so we really were operational inside the country here in the Western Cape. And we had a unit in Johannesburg, which Anil can talk to you about, for a 3-year-plus period, because it's a common understanding that when Nelson Mandela was released from prison and the ANC was unbanned and exiles returned and the prisons were opened and negotiations started, that MK was done and dusted. No, it wasn't. Actually, we had to remain combat ready for quite a number of years, until 1992, in fact, when officially we handed over our arms, and there was a process of applying for amnesty, or indemnity rather, not amnesty. And so we were officially then getting on with our lives from that moment onwards. So it was indeed a very, very long period. The life expectancy of any guerrilla fighter, and we were that, was 3 months. We survived a long time in the underground, in the command. We didn't retreat. We stayed in our base. We performed a number of successful operations in the time. And so, you know, let's count 5 years times 365 days. Let's start adding up the minutes. It was incredibly intense and incredibly long.
Yes, I hear you, because every minute would have been filled with a sort of tension. But you talk about the underground, and that's the title of your book, Voices from the Underground, in which 18 of you have told your stories, your experiences. Mm-hmm. And some 30 years later, that can't have been an easy job to do. You to rely on memories, which you describe as fragile. So how did it come about that it was decided to do the book?
You know, usually there's a spark, and the spark was the imperative of telling our stories. And when we got together and there was a possibility of the Human Rights Media Center, because we were working in the field of oral history and its multimedia dissemination for public awareness and education. So it was, we were aware of this particular National Heritage Council legacy project and the possibility of getting funding to tell our stories. So when it was a good fit and time, we met. And this was in October 2013, and there was a resounding yes, let us do it. You know, when we came out of the underground, and it was in a staggered process, because not all of the 18 in this book lived 100% in the underground. Some lived semi-underground lives, and some of us underground lives completely in disguise, a different name. There was not, in fact, a process within Mkhonto Wesizwe where we were debriefed. And so people carried their experience somehow, packaged it somehow, put it out of mind, carried it. And I think we probably, in that resounding yes, felt we can begin to process this experience. And that's what happened.
Really quite a psychological feat to cast back to all that and then in a way relive it. Chenille, what was the experience like? Did you have any way in which you had said, okay, this is what we're going to do? Because, I mean, each and every one of you tell your whole story, you know, contextualizing yourself, your own background. So how did it come about that you sat down and told your stories? Did you do it independently? You were interviewed? How did it work?
I think once we had the majority of the members who were in agreement that we tell our stories, Shirley was the one who was the overall coordinator and came up with a plan of how to conduct the interviews. As Shirley said, the organization she's the director of has had experience in compiling other stories, life stories, and had the expertise to be able to do this. And interviewed, there were actually 20 members who were at the start of the project, and Shirley interviewed 19 of them, and I interviewed Shirley. And through those interviews, we had an experience of one being able to relive some of it, and I think there was generally some trauma that we started to have to deal with. And I think in some cases it was a way of a catharsis, of release, of starting a process of healing. It allowed people to reflect on their lives, which they haven't had an opportunity to do, in the manner in which the interviews were conducted. The intention was to get to understand where people, their childhood, their life's journey through schooling, high schooling, their daily experiences of either living, many of the members were victims or their families were victims of forced removals. And they tell their stories about what impact that had on the way they were growing up. And then the activism in the 80s, especially the student activism, and also mass democratic movements, Christian organizations, trade unions, and all of that led to moving beyond political struggle, which is on the ground, to a stage where people were in their own time prepared to then take up arms and join MK. So these stories, in a way, chronicles those lives, and then post-94, what were their experiences with either integration into society or in a few cases into the army, and how their experiences were. As Shirley said, there was no debriefing. We were given, it was a legal thing, we were asked to sign a form to get indemnity so that against prosecution. Then on our way back to wherever we come from, in my case, I went back to Durban or to Tongaat. Others went back to living their lives. So there hasn't been that process of MK or the detachment being able to find ways of connecting with people. As you know, that the structure is a typical hierarchical military structure. So I didn't know many of the people on the ground. I knew the people on top and the unit I commanded in Johannesburg. But there were units in different parts of Cape Town and surrounding areas, and I got to meet them over time. This project allowed us to start for the first time meeting people who were part of this detachment and who we impacted in some way or another, you know, whether through the weapons I had brought over from Botswana, which got into their hands, which they then used in an operation, or so, you know, because our lives are all interlinked. So I think for me, the book project allowed us to bond and reconnect or connect in certain cases, and it created this very strong bonds of love and of appreciating how each one of us were prepared to give up our lives for the other, because we valued everyone's lives of comrades who were prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice with their lives, that we had been very disciplined in the way we work. So we had to be very responsible so that we don't in any way put any of the comrades' lives in danger.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons why we were able to survive for so many years.
Yes, I'm just thinking as you're talking that although you were working very closely together and your lives were impacting one another, and there must have been a huge amount of trust, but you wouldn't have really known one another all that well. So in putting together this book, you were in a way discovering one another, which is an enormous thing after all this time. But, you know, the book relies surely to a large extent on memory, because you had no written paperwork, because that would have jeopardized the whole detachment. So there were no photographs, there were no files or anything. So people really did have to dig deeply into their memory. Did that, the interview process, I mean, it helped that obviously that you knew a lot of the story, but did you find that the interview process helped release people's memories? How was the interview process? It must have been a bit like being a trauma counsellor.
I suppose so. It is very hard to remember the detail because we had no opportunity to keep any records and documentation. So parallel to this, there was a great deal of research so that we could get dates right, places right, news coverage right, etc. But because we are a group of people all speaking about our lives, which covers a similar period, one person story will jog the memory of another. And that's what you call a community oral history. So that came into play, particularly at the phase where we started reading each other's stories, prodding each other, saying, no, but maybe you forgot this, or wasn't it that date, and wasn't it there? And so the story shook into its right place. But that is indeed the fragility of memory, and being a group of people who have lived through a particular period of history, we could fill the gaps. Then, interestingly, particularly early childhood histories, many people had actually very little information, but the questions opened up a chapter of investigation themselves. They would go and speak to parents or grandparents or living relatives to find the gaps in their own knowledge. So there were phases in this project where people could add on through their own research, and then that would be integrated in that first person, in the flow of the story. Yes.
Yeah. So just on that, I mean, the thing about memory is that sometimes memories can be deceptive, and given that there were a number of you, your stories overlap quite considerably. Did you find that people remembered things differently, or the nuances of what they remembered were different, or they may even have had a completely different memory of something, which isn't to say that you were in conflict. It's just that people respond to things, especially something like this, very differently.
Yes, they were. There were times, there were moments in particular operations where quite adamantly one person would say, no, I did that, and another person would say, no, it happened then. And we had to produce the evidence, which was in microfilm at the National Library and police records, to straighten out the fault lines of memory, I would say. But as I said, it's very hard to remember, but it's also very hard to suppress memory. And things that you don't want to remember, it takes a great deal of energy to not remember. It's about those things that you remember and that you don't want to remember that are in interplay. And that's, you know, the degree to which people allow some feelings to emerge differed across the contributors. And I don't want to say all 18, but indeed the majority shed tears through the process of telling the stories, and they were long. What you read in a book is a summary. Some of the interviews were more than 10 hours long over three sessions or four sessions. You know, for a long time we've realized that we hold something very precious in our hands, and we've always been overwhelmed by the volume of it. So when this manuscript was handed over to Penguin Random House, it was double its length. And that was a journey, too, to bring it down to this manageable size for reticent South African readers.
Yes, I hear you. But nonetheless, the point is that it was a journey as well as the end product. For a lot of you, it must have triggered a lot of trauma. At the same time, it must have been quite a relief to get it off your chest after, you know, to have these stories heard for the first time. But I'm just thinking, it traumatic and triggering as it must have been for all of you, I imagine also, because you, each and every one of you, talk about your family members and where you've come from, for a lot of you, I imagine perhaps it was the first time that the families had heard all of this. Your parents, your siblings, how was that, Shanil? Did you, when you shared it with your family, did they say, but we had no idea? To what extent were your family aware of what you were doing?
Before I answer that, I think, I'm not sure Shirley, whether she mentioned it, each member was allowed to bring a member of the family or someone close to them when Shirley was interviewing them as a witness. And in many cases, it were their children or someone close to them. I didn't have that opportunity because I was in Cape Town when the interviews happened. What happened over the years is that my parents knew I was involved, especially when I was arrested in the Transkei in 1986, held in solitary confinement, and then they became aware of that and they traveled to the Transkei to see me. Beyond that, they didn't know the details even then, because the police wouldn't say what's my level of involvement. And so they knew I was politically involved, but not with the military, not with MK. And they knew it was something serious because everything had to be clandestine and I had to pass messages to my sister in Johannesburg. Obviously couldn't visit them and call them up and speak to them like any normal, you know, son would do. Yeah, so they were aware of it. And it was only when I received indemnity and when I went back home, then I gave them shared some of what I was doing. But I think what the book has done is it has now documented that, and now they can read it, and that can help. It's only my mom who's alive, and that can get them to understand some of my behaviors and understand what I had to go through. And I think, yeah, they're obviously very proud that I did what I had to do. But as parents, they would have preferred me to, whatever I did it so that I was safe. So I think, but also the other part was, through this book project, I got to speak to my mom more about my childhood and her childhood, and got to know things I never knew about my ancestry, which I write about in the book. And I think that got me to join the dots in a way. So where does my sense of social consciousness and activism comes from? And I could trace it, you know, to my grandparents or my great-grandparents. And obviously, it's also their experiences as indentured laborers and as, you know, workers and their struggles, and I growing up in a working class family. So there was that context which started to unravel and put the pieces together.
Gosh, it's really been it's been healing, I suppose that would probably be the right word, but it's also been enriching for so many reasons. Shirley, looking at the other end, I mean, you're talking, Shanil, about your parents and your siblings, but what about your children? Because certainly your oldest child was impacted very directly. You were incarcerated together. Looking back on it, how has it been for your children?
Well, let me go to my parents first. My dad had, although a medical doctor, he had a military history interest and active. He died in 1984, and I recall him speaking to somebody on the phone, and he was saying, oh, this one is fine and this one is fine. And then he came to me, the last of the five, and he said, oh, she's fine. She's not in the hands of the security police. I think he had a deeper sense of the dangers that my life choices were moving in. And he had a great deal of silence about the way in which, as a medical doctor, World War II impacted on him. It was a no-go topic. And my mum, when I handed over the first manuscript, well, she corrected something which was very valuable, but she stopped. She stopped at the point that Harun was born. She couldn't read further. That, for her, was a moment which she found very difficult to pursue. And then, of course, she was also involved in the case when the security police removed him from me, and she had to physically take that decision with the support of the lawyers to give him back to me under appalling conditions to security police. As a nursing sister, she would have had doubts about whether this was in the interests of the child. Now, my children, Harun, as we speak, he's speaking at the Nelson Mandela Foundation commemorative talk, which is happening in Houghton, with Yvonne Mokgoro and others, esteemed speakers. And we were having some conversation about Madiba, because this is the day he died, actually, it's to commemorate his life. Harun is an artist, and he's an activist because of his own life, which has been not easy. He has huge, huge heart for working with his medium. His medium is art and sculpture, to work with communities who have suffered, to tell their stories, to reach the world about what they went through. So he's done a range of projects, consulting and in collaboration with ordinary people. They've been very successful and very well received, and he's reached international acclaim at a very young age, and that is not easy for a young person. He's got blisters on his fingers from digging 118 graves at the Castle of Good Hope on the grass verge that flanks Darling Street. The graves represent those who were killed in detention and the need for us to continue digging for the truth. The irony is that it could have been his grave, it could have been my grave. So he's very much aware, even in this gesture of digging, he's been processing a lot of how close he was at the end of his life, as a baby, as an infant. So I think we find ways and means of working through our pain. Yes, that's Haroon, quite a remarkable person.
Well, he had quite a remarkable early start in his life. And you use the word there, appalling, and the words that, reading your stories, the words that spring to mind are appalling, shocking, terrifying. And I imagine that a lot of the time you were all living in some sort of post-traumatic stress. It must have been really awful. But the question for both of you is, going back over all these stories, would you have done anything different? Did you feel sometimes you were being foolhardy?
No, I don't think we were in any way foolhardy. I think that if
I... Putting your lives in danger.
Oh, well, that was a decision that we took individually. We were prepared to die for a cause, and we were very close to death. It was around the corner. No, I wish I had been able to do more. And I wish also that in the time that we were held up and we were holed up in houses with only the news, only each other. For me, what helps my concentration, what gives me some kind of, which nurtures me, is to work with my hands. I wish I had some art materials. I wish I had needle and thread. I wish I was able to, while in that long underground self lock and key state, that I'd had more ways of expressing my creativity. I think that would have made the endurance race a little easier.
Perhaps the way in which you have expressed your creativity is through eliciting these stories from people by sitting and listening to hours and hours, and in an empathetic way that's made people feel comfortable in doing that. It's a book of great magnitude. There are many lives here that have been impacted in all sorts of ways. Chenille, would you have done anything different? Do you look back on it and think, what was I thinking? Do you, any, maybe not regrets, but do you think it could have been different?
I think I was driven by what was in the MK Manifesto of 1961, and which Mandela, in his trial in Livonia, cited, which is at the start of this book. There comes a time in the life of any nation that you have two choices. It's either to submit or to fight. And I think if we go back and look at why MK was formed in 1961, it was due to the repression of the apartheid state against all organizations which were opposing apartheid. In 1960, the ANC, the PAC, SACTU, the SACP were all banned. There wasn't any room for peaceful political activism. And that forced people like Mandela and others in the Youth League to embark on an armed struggle. The ANCs had a history of pacifism until that point. And the state of emergency changed all of that. People had to go into hiding, into exile. We had a repetition of that in mid-1980s. P.W. brought a state of emergency. It brought the troops into the townships. It made any form of mass democratic struggles impossible. And even if you were not part of any radical groupings, you had no opportunity to be an activist. You were arrested, there were house arrests, and it was very difficult to operate. And the ANCs, as you know, had four pillars of struggle, and in the early 80s, the armed struggle became one of the pillars that was by necessary had to be strengthened. We had to intensify building units, detachments within the country to be able to withstand. At that time, we had no idea how long it'll have taken to overthrow apartheid. That we had to then make a decision. Do we submit or do we fight? And in my case, I grew up with a very strong influence of Gandhi and passive resistance. And I reached a point in by the mid-80s when I was at university that I would have to cross that line of pacifism and take up arms, because I just found that the repression of the state couldn't be met with any other form of resistance. It comes to you naturally. You get to a point after years of activism that you know that you're ready now to move to taking up arms. And it's not a light decision you make. And it's also not that you can just decide that you want to join. There's a process of joining. You have to be recruited into the ANC, and that's a process. So I think the commander in the Transkei who recruited me, after weeks of conversations, realized that I was ready to join MK. And since then, after spending a month in solitary confinement, and then the following year joining the AKD, it was the path I followed. It was the path I wouldn't. There was no return, no going back to that line which I had crossed. If I had to be true to myself, I couldn't do that. So I have no regrets about it. And I did it because I felt that was what was needed. And it was going to be a very difficult life to lead, because I spent many of those years living secretly, and the last few years deep underground with Shirley and Anise. It has had its toll, obviously, on each one of us, when you give up 6 years of your life, so in my case, and the toll it has on your family. And my dad had a stroke in the early 80s, in 83. A regret I talk about in the book is not being able to be there for him or for the family, and because he was medically boarded. My sister had to, as a nurse, support the family. So I thought I had those responsibilities, but I knew that they would understand that the decision I had taken was something they would have no problem with. Mm. So, yeah, but I think it's not something you take lightly. But I don't think, I think most of us, or maybe all of us, from the conversations with the other members, have no regrets of embarking on this journey.
Mm. Huge sacrifices. Shirley, at the beginning you said something about offering the book to a reticent public, I think that was the word that you used. They may be reticent, there'll be an awful lot of people who weren't even born when this was going on. What do you think is what is your hope for the book? That it will make people see things differently? What's the end purpose, aside from the journey being an end in itself? What are you hoping that people will understand from the book?
Well, firstly, I think it's presented in a way that it can reach multiple audiences, different ages. I think it is a suitable read for high school learners and studying history, those who don't know, were not part of the struggle, to those who were, because many who were will see resonance in their own lives, and hopefully it will stimulate them to also embark on sharing their stories, and for posterity, for the sake of our history. So I think that the audience is quite broad. I think that there are many international groupings that need to read this. So my hope is that people will appreciate the difficulty of sharing personal stories, firstly, and respect that. It will help them to understand how hard fought our democracy was and respect that, and also stimulate memoir writing or oral history projects of this kind.
Mm-hmm. Multi-pronged effect. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to say thank you both very much. Thank you very much for putting together the book, but thank you very much for what you did. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Nancy. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Nancy, for making the time, and I think the reflective questions you've asked hopefully will help your readers and people listening to the podcast to understand that that our struggle was against a system and not against a race of people, and that we would hope that more white people read this book, and especially Afrikaans-speaking people to read this book, so that they can, the ideological manipulation apartheid had on them, referring to us as terrorists, and understand where we're coming from and how peace-loving we are.